Breaking the Fast, today on The World. I'm Carol Hills. President Trump will host a special dinner this week in observance of Ramadan. Cue the critics who recall the president's strong anti-Muslim rhetoric. But others say this iftar dinner could be a positive moment.
This is, in fact, a time in which we should be more compassionate, we should be more kind, and we should give the man a chance to show us what he does at the iftar dinner. Who does he invite? How does he speak about Islam? That's the first thing.
Also, we hear how fasting for Ramadan can be challenging and rewarding at the same time.
The best part about fasting, I think, is being tested and having that temptation and feeling as if you really are sacrificing something.
Those stories and more ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and you're with The World. On again, off again. That's how official visits to the White House can be these days. Just ask the Philadelphia Eagles. Or consider the celebration of iftar. That's the meal served at the end of the day during the Islamic holy month of Ramadan. The past three presidents have hosted one of these meals at the White House every Ramadan. But President Trump broke with tradition last year when he decided not to host the event. Then on Monday, White House officials announced that the dinner was back on again. President Trump's White House will hold an iftar dinner tomorrow night. Farah Pandith is the former State Department Special Representative to Muslim Communities. As far as she's concerned, this is a good thing.
This is a welcome change to the way the White House has decided to use signals in a wide variety of ways. And in particular, this particular event allows the Commander-in-Chief to reboot, if you will. And if he takes this opportunity, we will see.
But many corners of the internet are not applauding this White House announcement. I mean, some on Twitter, they're joking around and predicting the appetizers would be pigs in a blanket with a main course of pork chops. I mean, can you blame people for being skeptical?
Of course. I mean, there's been a lot of snark on Twitter around the Ramadan event that the White House announced. But while it is understandable, this is, in fact, the holy month of Ramadan. And much of the snark that's coming from the Muslim quarter of Twitter has been interesting to me, because this is, in fact, a time in which we should be more compassionate, we should be more kind, and we should wait and see, give the man a chance to show us what he does at the iftar dinner. Who does he invite? How does he speak about Islam? How does he speak about the holy month of Ramadan? That's the first thing. The iftar tradition is not just a modern one, and it is important for us to remember, as Americans, where this tradition started and why it started and how American presidents have thought about Islam from the very moments our country began. Islam has been part of our country. Many of the slaves that came to our nation on slave ships were, in fact, Muslim. So it has been part of our country since the very beginning. And toward that end, when we look at the way American presidents have talked about Islam, have talked about Muslims, every single president up until the current one has spoken with respect, has spoken with dignity, and has done quite a bit in their administrations to open up conversations and dialogue in a very dignified way. Celebration meals to break the fast went as far back as President Jefferson. But we can also see other signals that presidents, whether it's Reagan or Eisenhower or George W. Bush, made that were very historic moments for our country around how they sent the signal to fellow Americans and those abroad about how they think about Islam. Whether it is President Bush, who put Quran in the White House library for the first time in American history, or President Eisenhower, who donated land so the first mosque could be built in Washington, D.C.
But doesn't this provide him with basically a photo op to essentially play both ends of the street?
Carol, it's far beyond a photo opportunity. One piece of this is certainly what is in the actual speech. What does the president say? Both President George W. Bush and President Obama both chose to announce specific things in their speeches. It was beyond the, let me tell you what I know about Islam, but here are some more things we're going to do.
But in this case, this is a president who, first of all, didn't have the iftar dinner last year and has been accused of spreading Islamophobia. So the context is
slightly
different.
The president has done, yes, the context is extremely different. You had a candidate, Trump, who was inflaming the us and them rhetoric around Muslims. You had a president, Trump, who within the first few days of being president talked about the Muslim ban. You had Michael Flynn, one of his closest advisors, speaking about Islam as an ideology rather than a religion. And you obviously hear President Trump talking about Islam connected to terrorism and not pulling apart those who use the name of Islam for their violent means and those who practice Islam around the world. No question about it. The context is extremely different. But what I'm saying here today is he is the commander-in-chief for all Americans, including American Muslims.
But doesn't simply being invited to this iftar dinner under this president, given the context we just talked about, doesn't that put people who are invited in a difficult position? Like, if they go, they're being snookered. If they don't go, they're not giving them a chance. I mean, it's a tough position.
It's a tough position if you choose to look at it in that way. You can also look at it from the perspective, and having been at the White House during the Bush administration, having worked on the iftar myself, I know that you are never, ever going to have a group of people who are 100% behind every president that is behind the podium and or who is hosting you that day. And that is true for the Obama team as well. You are choosing guests depending on the signals that you want, that the White House wants to put forward. So I don't know what President Trump's team has decided to do, but I think that's important, Carol. Somebody on his team convinced President Trump to do something different that he didn't, you know, that he did. He's made a huge change in his positioning around this particular event.
Would you go if you were invited by the Trump White House?
I think it's important as an American when the commander-in-chief is changing course in the way in which he is trying to engage with Muslims to give him a chance. And I think if I were invited, I would go. I am an American. I'm proud of our country. And I understand that this is a change. I would like to hear what he has to say.
Do you think there'd be a backlash if you accepted an invitation?
This isn't about a public stunt. This is about the principles that I stand for and who I am and the way I'm invited to anything that I go to. I don't approve of the way the president has spoken about not just Islam, but other faiths, other issues around race. So it's not just religion. It's not just about Islam. It's about dignity for all. It's about respect. And he has not demonstrated that in a multitude of different ways. I don't know what's going to be in his speech tomorrow. I don't know what message he's trying to deliver. I don't know who he's invited. I don't know if he is rebooting. I don't know if he is going to announce a new program of engagement. I have no idea. And that is why it's important for us to give an opportunity to the president to show us what he wants to do with this event and then be critical. We can't be critical before we know what it is he's doing.
For those who do attend the iftar dinner tomorrow, what should they expect to see on social media the next day, and does it even matter?
If American Muslims decide to be critical, there's no movement of sort of one effort that is speaking for all kinds of American Muslims. I think the question is who responds, how they respond, and what's the platform that they're coming from. There's not one version of Islam in this country. And so I think you're going to hear a lot of different perspectives on the guest list. And I think you're going to hear, I hope, some intellectual conversations about either the way he sees the moment or how he did not.
Thanks a lot, Farah.
Thank you so much.
Farah Pandith was the State Department's special representative to Muslim communities. Her forthcoming book about fighting extremism is called How We Win. Fasting for Ramadan can be tough for pretty much anyone, but spare a thought for the folks in our next segment. I'm talking about men and women who are fasting during daylight hours, but they spend all day preparing and serving food to the public. This got video producer Ayman Ismail thinking, what's it like to be a Muslim food truck owner during the month of Ramadan? We're about halfway through the holy month, by the way. Ismail was born to Egyptian parents, and he grew up in New Jersey. He now lives in New York, so a few days ago, he hopped on a train to go meet some Muslims in the food truck business.
New Yorkers are hungry. They like to eat.
Mix it up, half and half. And yeah, you got veggies in there. That's great.
New York, and in Manhattan specifically, there's a food truck on every corner. Every single person working these halal trucks is more or less going to probably be a Muslim. They're not all Muslim, but for the most part, you can pretty much count on the halal trucks being operated and owned by a Muslim guy. these people are putting themselves to the test, not just their mind, but their body and their soul and everything, cooking in these tin boxes nonstop for New Yorkers because they got bills to pay, you know?
My name is Adil. This is the last name, Sayed. Okay? I've been in this country 41 years ago, born in Egypt. White sauce?
Yeah, white sauce.
Are you fasting today?
Of course I'm fasting today. You don't have to ask me this question. I never, listen to me. If you give me like all the money on this, on the wallet, I can break one day.
You wouldn't break your fast for $1 million?
More than.
$10 million?
No.
Million dollars?
No, nothing.
The best part about fasting, I think, is being tested and having that temptation and feeling as if you really are sacrificing something. We don't eat, we don't drink, we don't smoke, we don't curse, we don't have impure thoughts, we don't have sexual intercourse during the day. This one on here has a hot sausage, a hot commodity here in New York City, some pretzels, the drinks on the outside, I love it.
My name is Reda. I am in 49 and 6th Avenue. I am in a kitchen more than 40 years, and I don't feel hungry. Every day chicken is chicken, you know. Relationship between me and chicken more than between me and my wife, you know, 30 years.
And if you're fasting in a place like Egypt or fasting in a place like, you know, take your pick, you aren't walking past people eating to the same pedigree that you are in a place like America. You aren't having to constantly explain why you're doing and having to test your own conviction constantly in the same way that you would in a place like New York. So I love that about fasting in America. This happens every Ramadan. I don't know how it happens. As soon as people know that I'm fasting, they start bringing free snacks to the office. For example, today one of my coworkers made homemade Oreos. Homemade Oreos? Are you kidding? Are you joking? Another food truck in this direction.
My name is Ibrahim El Said. Okay. I'm fasting when like 6 years old, you know. When I'm 6 years old, I'm fasting, you know. Alhamdulillah.
Like, well, what's hotter, the food truck or Egypt?
No, I think here is hard because Egypt, you know, everybody is fasting. And here, you know, you see the people drinking and eating. And, so only here is hard. Yeah.
So another thing about fasting in America is your neighbors who really feel sympathy for you. You know, they feel bad for you. They're all going to start eating their lunches in closets because they don't want me to see the food. That's not what this is about. Part of what makes the human experience so special is the fact that we're all different and we can learn from each other. So I think we don't need that. We don't need people to feel bad for us. We love it. I love it.
Ayman Ismail is a video producer and editor for Slate. His video series is called Who's Afraid of Ayman Ismail? Here's a quick preview of a story we're working on for tomorrow. You've heard that hundreds of migrant parents and their children are being separated when they cross the U.S. border. Tomorrow, we meet a mother from Guatemala and her daughter. They haven't seen each other since they were split up after entering the U.S. illegally. The mother was devastated. Her daughter, Maria, was 6 years old at the time. Maria remembers being really, really confused.
I didn't understand them. I kept saying, And then when they took my mom, I got scared and just didn't understand anything.
Maria says she and her mom were threatened by her stepdad in Guatemala, and that's why they fled to the U.S.
She would bleed from her face. The man would be drunk and he would hit her. He would take her.
One family's ordeal and efforts to prevent more such separations. That's tomorrow. I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World. The new U.S. ambassador to Germany has been on the job less than a month, but some German lawmakers are already calling for him to be expelled. The ambassador, Richard Grenell, is an outspoken supporter of Donald Trump, and he's a former commentator at Fox News. Grenell was also a spokesman for the U.S. mission to the United Nations under George W. Bush. But comments he made over the weekend have landed him in hot water in Germany. Grinnell told the far-right website Breitbart London that he, quote, absolutely wants to empower other conservatives throughout Europe. In the eyes of some German politicians, that crossed a line. Stefan Cornelius is foreign editor of the liberal-leaning paper, the Süddeutsche Zeitung. Stefan, why are some Germans so angry with that comment about empowering other conservatives throughout Europe?
A couple of reasons. First, this is indeed very undiplomatic. This is what a diplomat shouldn't be doing, that he is interfering in the political sphere of his host country. It's actually part of the diplomatic protocol and the conventions which rule behavior of diplomats, that they do not interfere with domestic political situations. So it's a very unusual thing that an ambassador, especially from the United States, takes side for a political movement or for one political idea. Second, he is extremely direct and blunt. And even though there have been American ambassadors who were extremely direct and blunt, especially on defense issues where Germany has a tendency to lag behind with its commitments, there has never been any who, after such a short time, without being sort of having arrived in the country and knowing the game and knowing the players, is playing a political game. And now all of a sudden, there seems to be a new actor in town.
Realistically, though, diplomats have always sought to influence opinion in their host countries to suit their own nation's interests. I mean, many have meddled politically. What's the difference here with Grinnell?
The difference is that he's taking a specific side with the party landscape. Usually ambassadors interfere if issues are conflicting with the country they represent. So in the American case, that's usually defense issues or trade issues. Now, an ambassador is supposed to represent the whole country and to connect or collect opinion from all parts of politics. If you only side with one very small margin of the political landscape in your host country, you definitely do not serve that purpose. And this is why Germans who are not that politically beefed up, as probably the American landscape now is, feel so alienated.
What's your guess about what, if anything, might happen to Richard Grinnell?
I think nothing will happen to him, because this is exactly what he's here for to do. This is why he came to Germany. This is why the president chose him. He is his message man in Europe, and he's not only in charge of Germany. His task is to be an influencer in Europe on the cause of conservative populist movement, basically on Trumpism in Europe. And the way he's already drawing those who think there is something to copy in Trump, the line of those people is already amazing. For example, the German health secretary, Jens Spahn, claims to be a friend of Richard Grinnell. They meet socially. They do meet privately. They exchange sort of adoring tweets. And so there is sort of a small followership already building. Stephen Bannon happens to be still in Europe, coming in and out, now claiming that he is the one who masterminded the new Italian populist government. He is aligning with him. So this is a group of people who now take a foothold in Europe, and they have their friends, and definitely the Austrian Chancellor Kurz, who is only 30-something, 31, is their poster boy. He's a very conservative, smart young guy who speaks their language. And so we do seem to have a nucleus of a political avant-garde who brings Trump thinking to Europe.
Stefan Cornelius is with the Süddeutsche Zeitung. Thanks so much, Stefan.
Sure, you're welcome.
Our next story comes from Nigeria, and it's about women there who are gay or transgender pushing to have their voices heard. That's the goal of She Called Me Woman, a new anthology that gives LGBT women from across Nigeria a platform to tell their stories. The BBC's Myeni Jones spoke to some of those involved with the book.
I'm Azina Muhammad, Nigerian, and I'm one of the editors for She Called Me Woman, Nigerian Queer Women Speak. I came out to my family over social media. I sent a message on BBM to my mom, and I told her I wanted her to meet my girlfriend. And she asked me, are you two getting married? I was like, no, we're just dating. My mom's reaction was what it was, and my sister was like, yeah, we always knew, just get it over with. But then, when I publicly came out on a national platform, and it was all over the news, their reaction was different. My mom got super upset, my siblings got super upset, and they wanted me to take it back. So being out private and being out public, again, is a different issue because it's okay for them to know, but I guess they don't want society to know.
Being out in Nigeria is a big deal. In 2014, the Same-Sex Marriage Prohibition Act was passed, criminalizing gay marriage and public shows of affection. Punishments range from 10 to 14 years in prison. For HK, not her real name, the prospect of being outed led to a revelation.
And what happened was, my place of work, I had the responsibility of firing someone, and she said, "You bloody lesbian." And it felt like my entire world was ending. And for the first time, I felt ashamed of who I was.
What do you think you can achieve by having your story told in this anthology?
Teenagers nowadays could go to social media and say, "Oh, I'm a lesbian," or see some lesbian group and join such groups. Growing up, I didn't have that. I thought I was the only one that was a lesbian. And now that I'm an adult, I want to give the opportunity to anybody who has meant to read the book that there are other lesbians living in Nigeria and they're not alone.
It's the same drive for inclusivity and representation that led Azina to include the voices of trans as well as gay women in her book.
I think it was the only thing that made sense. Trans women are women too, and we wanted to cover a variety of women who serve under the cover of queerness, and that it was very important to us that trans women were included in that conversation.
And this brings us to something JP is keen to emphasize.
In Nigeria, they mix up gender identity with sexual orientation. Gender identity is who you identify as. Your sexual orientation is who you're attracted to.
I asked contributors HK and JP what advice they had for other queer Nigerian women.
First and foremost, you need to be empowered. So for a young lesbian living in Nigeria, you just have to develop yourself and make sure that you're financially empowered and you don't need anybody. You don't have to sleep with anybody or ask your parents for money to survive.
So I try to make trans people know that, look, they should have a good self-esteem, self-image. Look into the mirror. Okay, who do you see? Heal first. Be happy with who you are.
The voices of women featured in She Called Me Woman, a new anthology that tells the stories of LGBT women in Nigeria. They were speaking there to the BBC's Myeni Jones. I'm Carol Hills. Indigenous farmers in the highlands of Peru have seen gold mines destroy their land before.
Our blood has been spilled over this gold. That is what I want people to know. So they think about what is happening to us when they buy their gold.
A Peruvian community fights back, just ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and you're with The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. People in Guatemala are still recovering from Fuego. That's the name of the volcano that erupted on Sunday. It killed at least 69 people so far, but the death toll is likely to be much higher because so many people are still missing. Guatemala has been through volcanic eruptions before, but this was the worst in decades. Many of the survivors have found emergency shelter in the nearby town of Escuintla. Luis Rolando Sanchez is there. He's with Catholic Relief Services, and I spoke with him earlier.
Right now, the emergency teams are trying to recover bodies because they don't think there is anybody alive so far. Why? Because the lava makes the ground really warm, really hot. When they're trying to get into the houses, they break into the houses. They can't stay more than 2 or 3 minutes inside because it's really warm. They have to use special boots or to go through a special road or a way to walk because the mud is really, really warm. Right now they're using these caterpillar trucks to try to remove some mud and lava to try to find more bodies.
Have you spoken to any of the people who were able to evacuate and escape the volcano?
Yes, the team of Catholic Relief Services and Caritas have been around the 3 shelters that the Catholic Church opened. They are having around 600 sheltered people. We have spoke to many people, and they are shocked still. They are looking for their family members. We have seen a lot of orphans we have heard that they're still looking for people in the places where they have the deaf persons, and they are suffering because of that. Yesterday we had this lady with her little baby of 27 days old with her husband. They were taking care of three little girls. Their parents died along with the little other baby. So they are like three new orphans with another family of poor people. And still their aunt, this is going to be really sad.
So these babies and children lost their parents in the volcano?
Yes, yes. We're going to have a lot of orphans.
How many kids
You know what? I guess I will have to hang out right now. We are passing through a place where it's kind of warm next to the river. So we can call later. If you want, I'm sorry.
All right. That's all right. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Luis Rolando Sanchez is with Catholic Relief Services. He's currently in Guatemala helping with relief efforts after the eruption of the volcano there. Yesterday on the show, we heard a story from Peru about one woman's stand against a large U.S. mining company called Newmont. The company, through its Peruvian subsidiary, wants to open a new gold mine in the Peruvian highlands. Local farmers oppose the mine because they've seen how gold mines destroy the natural landscape. SR reporter Deepa Fernandez picks up the story today on horseback.
I'm heading up a steep mountain in the highlands of Peru. Come on, Blanco, you can do it. Horse's name's Blanco. My guide is a 19-year-old named Abraham, who's loaned me his horse. He and his father, Pedro, are taking me to see their patch of farmland, which overlooks a massive mine. As we get higher, the air gets much thinner, and the stunning mountain ranges that surround us become clearer. Along the way, Abraham, the teenager, is telling me what it's like to grow up next to a huge gold mine.
Sea como la minera está muy cerca a nosotros y eso pucha que una explosión mueve a.
The mine is so close to us. Jeez, the explosion shakes things. It's kind of like an earthquake. Our houses crack, the roofs get damaged, and then the next day the whole family has to fix it because if we don't, then the rain will come in.
As we ride up the mountain, we pass a gushing stream close to the family's hut. The water is a startling color.
This water is yellowish, brown, almost like coffee. But it's not coffee. It's contaminated. This water is what the people and the animals and the grass and the crops need. But we can't use this cloudy water. The mining company operations have caused this for sure. I think that water has gasoline, oil, and other chemicals in it. See high up there? There's a dump site, and the waters come through it and get contaminated.
Wherever it's coming from, Pedro is convinced it's not healthy.
Two months ago, two of my cows died right here. See, they drink the water, and then a few minutes later, you see them change. They get sad, and just an hour or two later, they fall to the ground and die.
I should add that the mining company Yanacocha will insist that they're good stewards of the environment, but I couldn't press them on specifics about cows and bad water because they didn't respond to several interview requests. Finally, just up ahead, near the summit, is a view of the mine itself. We've just rounded a corner, whole series of mine pits falls out, carved amid lush green mountains. In some places it's so perfectly excavated, it kind of looks like pyramids. Looks like some ancient pyramids. Once we're high up, Pedro, Abraham, and the others scamper off to look at a different part of the mining operation. I'm left alone. It's both eerie and mesmerizing. If I turn my head all the way to the left, it's just a stunning mountain, lush green, almost Switzerland-like view. And then I swivel my head back around this way, and there's whole mountains that have been dug away. Excavated down, deep pits of brown and gold and bronze. This is the gold mine.
So people will say, look, there's this giant company here with electricity, with running water that we don't have, and they're taking all our richness, destroying our environment.
Alonso Gurmende is a professor of law in Lima.
And the company will say, well, I pay my taxes. So there's this prejudice that the company is like this neoliberal evil thing, and that the campesino is just a troublemaker, and there's no way of breaching that divide.
He says part of the problem harks back to the Spanish colonizers. 500 years ago, the Spanish colonizers came here, right here to the province of Cajamarca, up in the Andes Mountains, specifically to take gold. What locals like Pedro believe is that the foreign companies here today are no different from the Spanish who stole the gold. Professor Gurmendi says the law the Spanish set up then still applies today.
The structure is based so that once you know that there's something underneath, it's not yours. The government will do a legal tender and select which company is going to extract that good. The company gets a legal property right over something that's underneath your property. So here comes the company and says, I already have a right to what's underneath your land. So let's negotiate the surface. Where do I put my mine? But I'm going to put my mine here no matter what, because I already have a right to this.
A bunch of the world's gold has come from Peruvian mines. One of the big players here is the American corporation Newmont, which extracts gold through its local partner, Minera Yanacocha. But its mines near Pedro's property, which a decade ago were extracting gold at high rates, have now slowed in production. So looking for new sources of gold is what a gold mining company does. And when word came out of the new mines the company wanted to start, well, the community resisted. Massive protests began, which brings us to Maxima Acuña Talaya, the potato farming grandmother I introduced you to yesterday, the face of the local resistance to the mine because of the ecological destruction more mining would bring to the mountains, the water sources, and her own farm. Maxima can't read or write, but she can, quite poetically, tell me how it feels when a powerful foreign corporation shows up and says, hey, your land? It's rich in gold. We want it. Scoot.
Se llevan el oro de nuestras tierras, que nos cuesta a nosotros tanto sufrimiento.
When they take the gold from our lands, it costs us a lot of suffering. They mistreat us, they beat us. I don't think they will see their gold as precious when they know that for us it's our tears, it's our blood, it's hunger and suffering, all to get the gold. It leaves us crying. Our blood has been spilled over this gold. That is what I want people to know. So they think about what that is happening to us when they buy their gold, because we wouldn't do this kind of harm to them.
For years, according to Maxima, she and her family have been tormented by what she calls agents of the mining company Yanacocha, which is owned by Newmont, a U.S. corporation on the stock exchange. Once in 2011, a group of men and police officers with riot shields showed up to the farm. Maxima says they were beaten badly. The incident was caught on cell phone camera by Maxima's daughter, Isadora.
Señores, por favor, necesito apoyo, necesito ayuda. Miren acá cómo están.
The company categorically denies that any of the police present beat or harassed the family that day. As Maxima was feeling increasingly isolated, word of her struggle came to Ryan Mack at his desk in downtown San Francisco.
In talking about Maxima, it was the story of a woman and her family at the top of a mountain in Peru, standing up to one of the largest mining companies in the world to protect her land and protect water and resources in rural Peru.
Mack's organization, the Goldman Environmental Prize, kind of the Green Nobel, was about to award Maxima its annual prize. Her acceptance speech in front of a packed theater in San Francisco was a song.
Yo soy una jalqueñita. Yo soy una jalqueñita. Que vivo en las cordilleras. Que vivo en las cordilleras. Pasteando mis ovejas. Pasteando mis ovejas. En neblina y aguacero.
The Goldman Prize was outside recognition of Maxima's resistance. she accepted it on behalf of the growing movement against the new mines. And, it seems, the company heard the people's discontent.
Well, the project has been effectively suspended.
Milton Sanchez is a local environmental activist who has helped coordinate the protests against the mining operations.
The company made the decision because of the strong opposition from the community. There were constant mobilizations. Thousands protested in the streets in all our major towns around here, and they rejected the expansion of the mine.
Now, I did get the Newmont Corporation to weigh in on this by email, and they say they won't proceed with the mine until they get, quote, social acceptance. See, it's acknowledged by Newmont that it needs a supportive community around its mine site, kind of what's known as a social license. It's like community approval. Because even if companies pay their taxes, get the right permits, build schools for locals, they still need local buy-in, or, in theory, their mine is doomed.
Y por todos que estamos en lucha en Cajamarca.
So that should be the end of the story. But according to Maxima, it's not. Maxima says 7 years later, the company still bothers her family. See, if the Chalpe family leaves, the mining project would likely start.
Recently, over the last month, they come and bother us once a week or every 8 days. Sometimes they take photos. Before, they were coming daily, day and night.
So Maxima is one tough woman.
Mariam Jordan is an attorney for Earth Rights International, an NGO that is representing Maxima in another case. This one ordering the mining company to stop harassing the family. Newmont denies the charges. This case was actually filed in the U.S. because Newmont is a U.S. company, but the American court said, nope, not our jurisdiction, take this case to Peru. Jordan says the Chalpe family needs resolution, which 7 years later they still don't have. She spent time on Maxima's land. She's seen up close what the family are dealing with, why they refuse to move.
The Chalpes realize how their struggle is symbolic, especially for other campesino families.
This struggle in Peru of one woman and her community against a multinational company, well, at the end of the day, it's all about gold. I wanted to know how Maxima feels about this metal that's so valuable, so sought after.
Bueno, yo no... No conozco cuál es el anillo, cuál es el arete, cuál es un collar de oro.
You know, I don't have a gold ring or gold necklaces or gold earrings. And truthfully, I have no desire for those things. But I know people want gold rings and or a gold chain. And they feel pretty and they feel luxurious with these things on their bodies. But, well, you know, that is how I feel about my land. And I have the same desire for my land. My land makes me feel luxurious. It is my life and my protection.
Me da la vida, la protección.
For the world, Deepa Fernandez, Cajamarca, Peru.
There are only two places in the world that do not allow divorce. One is Vatican City, the other is the Philippines. As you may have guessed, Catholicism is the common factor here. But a bill to legalize divorce is making its way through the legislature in the Philippines. If it passes, that would be a huge deal, not just for millions of people there, but for millions of Filipinos who work overseas. Catherine Fung is a reporter based in New York. Catherine, before this bill passed in the Philippines House of Representatives, what options were there for married couples that wanted to break up?
So the only option available to married couples in the Philippines is to get an annulment. What that means is essentially the marriage was never valid to begin with. To get that, people have to prove that the other spouse was psychologically incapacitated when they got married. It's really hard to prove, and it requires getting lawyers and psychologists to make assessments. So it's very expensive, the equivalent of thousands of US dollars. And that traps a lot of middle class and working class people in marriages that don't work anymore and some relationships that are abusive.
Do couples go ahead and separate and just have informal arrangements, or do couples tend to just stay together because they can't seek the annulment?
A lot of couples do tend to informally separate, but it creates problems because there's no formal way to get child custody or to get alimony. And if one of them buys property, it's automatically conjugal property. So it belongs to the other estranged spouse too. What happens is that people are giving up their rights because they can't get divorced.
How does this affect the more than 2 million Filipinos who work abroad and send their remittances back home?
So I talked to a number of women in New York who are from the Philippines and who are in this situation now where they can't get out of their marriages. And this affects them in a couple of different ways. They struggle because they can't buy property in the Philippines if they want to retire there someday or go home, which many of them do. And if they can't reach an agreement with their spouses to bring their children here or to share custody, there's really no way for them to go about it. I talked to one woman named Nariza, who is a nanny now in New York. She couldn't get divorced, but she said there was no way she could stay with her husband.
Gambling, women, drugs was there. So it was the thing that pushes me out because I was already worried about the future of my children.
So in her case, are her children still back in the Philippines?
Her children are in the Philippines. Her children are grown now. The youngest is 24, but her child was 5 when she left.
Now, this divorce bill, which is being debated, how would it change things?
It would basically lower the bar for people who want to end their marriages. Instead of having to prove psychological incapacity, they could get a divorce based on reasons like infidelity, spousal abuse, or irreconcilable differences.
And what sort of support is it finding among Filipinos?
There have been public opinion surveys in the Philippines, and right now, the majority of Filipinos support divorce being passed. It's a slight majority, and one of the reasons why this is such a big debate right now is because the Philippines is strongly Catholic, and the Catholic Church doesn't support divorce. There have been attempts to legalize divorce in the past, but this past year, the momentum is stronger because divorce advocates really believe that the current Congress is more likely to approve this bill.
Do Filipinos working abroad, are they a strong base of support for the divorce bill?
Yeah, so overseas workers groups around the world overwhelmingly support this bill. And in fact, this bill was partly written with them in mind. Lawmakers in the Philippines have said that they are supporting this in part because they've been hearing from workers and workers groups around the world. And if it passes, it will give priority to workers to streamline the process for them. Nariza, the woman who nannies in New York, she supports the bill, but she's aware of how controversial it is in the Philippines.
Some other people will gonna disagree with this, especially religious groups. But for me, I hope they will understand this. I'm also a religious woman, a mother. I've really tried, but we're just human.
Now, this bill needs the president's approval before it can become law. Is Rodrigo Duterte likely to support it?
He said in March that he wouldn't support it. He believes that legalizing divorce would break up families. And there is really no deadline for this bill to be voted on. So the future is unclear at the moment.
Catherine Fung is a reporter based in New York. Her story comes to us via our Global Nation Reporting Fund. Thanks a lot, Catherine.
Thank you.
Today marks 50 years since Robert F. Kennedy was shot in Los Angeles. So to close out the show, we want to remember a speech he gave 2 years before he died. It was in South Africa at the height of apartheid. The date was June 6, 1966. The place, the University of Cape Town. Many consider it RFK's finest speech.
We must recognize the full human equality of all of our people. Before God, before the law, and in the councils of government. We must do this not because it is economically advantageous, although it is, not because the laws of God command it, although they do, not because people in other lands wish it so. We must do it for the single and fundamental reason that it is the right thing to do.
Kennedy urged his audience to demolish barriers of race and religion, social class and ignorance, to usher in a new order. He was invited to speak in South Africa by the head of the anti-apartheid National Union of South African Students. At the time, Nelson Mandela was in prison, and H.F. Verwoerd, who was known as the architect of apartheid, was the prime minister. The South African government didn't want to give Kennedy a visa, but it was worried about offending the man many thought would be the next president of the United States. In the speech and in Kennedy's meetings with banned ANC leaders, he reassured anti-apartheid activists that they were not alone.
Each time a man stands up for an ideal or acts to improve the lot of others or strikes out against injustice, he sends forth a tiny ripple of hope, and crossing each other from a million different centers of energy and daring, those ripples build a current which can sweep down the mightiest walls of oppression and resistance.
Those words are carved on Robert F. Kennedy's gravesite, and to many, they'll sound just as relevant today as they were then. That's all from us today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Carol Hills. Back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.